Okay. So let us continue where we left off yesterday afternoon. So this, we are still working on the Dveda Vitakka Sutta, two kinds of thoughts, Majjhima Nikaya number 19. And we're looking at how to overcome the negative, the defiled thoughts, and how to give rise to positive or conducive thoughts, thoughts that are conducive to the practice, conducive to meditation, etc. So now we're going to look at the positive side of this. And we just finished the how to overcome the negative ones. So where are we? So this is how it goes then. As I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with too long, too much thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when my body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from samadhi. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. So here we see the other side of the equation. So first of all, we overcome the bad thoughts, and then, of course, once they are overcome, what remains are the positive kind of thoughts. So here, a thought of renunciation arose in me. So what is a thought of renunciation? What does that actually mean? What it means, it is a thought where you turn away from sensuality. You understand that sensual pleasures are a problem, that they are a danger, that they will lead to suffering in the future, and that therefore your mind turns away from that. And that is a thought of renunciation. So you are contemplating this theme of the danger in sensual pleasures, essentially. And then, of course, this does not lead to affliction, right? For oneself, for others, it aids wisdom. So in other words, it is a positive thought. It's a thought that takes you on the way to awakening. But even these kind of positive thoughts, even though, as the Buddha says here, there's nothing to fear from them, even if you think about them all the time, the only problem is that you get tired after a while, right? Your mind gets strained, and then it is far from samadhi, as it says here. And this is one of the problems with the thinking mind. In the end, if you want to have the energy, if you want to have the brightness, if you want to have the power of the mind that can penetrate the truth and can, you know, from samadhi, you have to let go of all thinking. All thinking, in the end, tires the mind out. So this is the... this is then what he does. He overcomes the thinking, and then he brings the mind, as it says here, internally, steadies it internally, quieted it, brings it to singleness, and stilled it, concentrated it, samahita. And these are words that are used for samadhi in the suttas, and quite specifically, it usually refers to things like the states, the jhana states. And then when you do that, then the mind does not become strained internally. So you can see here, you see a progression in the way that the path is developed. The first aspect of the path, which is by far the most difficult one, is to overcome all the negative states, all the negative thoughts, all the negative perceptions. That's the first one. When they are overcome, at least mostly, it's never overcome completely, right? But it's mostly overcome, except if you're an arahant or anagami, but overcome to a large extent. Then the second stage is to overcome the remaining thoughts. And then when the remaining thoughts are overcome, then you go to samadhi. It's a stage-wide process. And the overcoming of the negative thoughts itself, it goes through many stages. You start off with the coarser negative thoughts, then the more refined ones, and then eventually the really refined ones. And if you want to read more about that, you can have a look at the sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya called the... gold refining, gold refiner, something like that. It is roughly around Anguttara, it's in the Tika Nipata, the threes, I think around 99 or 100 or something like that. The Sutta on the Simile of Gold Refining. It's a very nice one. I did it here a couple of years ago when I was here 2 years ago, but not this time. Okay, so that is that. I'm going to go through the rest a little bit more quickly than I did yesterday, because it's a bit more, this part of it is not as involved, perhaps. Actually, it could be, but we won't make it that this time around. As I abided thus, diligent, energetic, and resolute, a thought of non-ill will, or I could be metta, arose in me, a thought of non-harming, or non-harshness or ruthlessness arose in me. That's like compassion. I understood thus, a thought of non-harming has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to Nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body, and when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained, and when the mind is strained, it is far from concentration or stillness. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and stilled it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. The same idea again. And then we have the simile again. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of non-ill will, of metta, upon thoughts of non-harming, compassion, he has abandoned the thought of harming to cultivate the thought of non-harming, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of non-harming. Right? Isn't that nice when your mind inclines to the thoughts of these positive thoughts? This is one of those great things when that happens. You can feel your mind leaning in that direction. And of course, it makes the whole practice so much more easy. And this is what is supposed to happen when you want to do practice meditation and you sit down and you close your eyes. As you kind of abandon the world outside of you, you close your eyes, you let the world outside of you disappear. If your mind inclines to the positive thinking, it means that as you let go of everything, the daily activities and all these things, the mind automatically goes to those positive thoughts. So this is kind of the idea here, is that, and when you sit down in meditation, you kind of incline that way. You watch the breath, right? And the mind at the same time inclines towards the positive states. It makes it easy to watch the breath. It makes it easy to do the meditation practice. So this is the ideal here. This is what we're trying to reach. And then we have the simile again. The similes are always very useful in the suttas. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been brought inside the villages, a cowherd would guard his cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since he needs only to be mindful that the cows are there. So too, there was need for me only to be mindful that those qualities were there. Right, so now the cowherd, he doesn't have to tap the cows to check and curb them. Right, before you had to tap the cows this way and that way, you had to tap the mind this way and that way to make sure it doesn't stray into the unwholesome states. Now there are no crops, there are no sensual desire. It's kind of abandoned, it's not there anymore. So all you can do is just chill, right? You sit at the root of a tree, you sit on your meditation seat, right? You close your eyes, and all you do is you're just mindful, you're just aware. And then, of course, you have enough clear comprehension, enough sampajanya, that you, if an unwholesome state does arise, then you know how to abandon it if that happens. But you just have to be aware that the good states are, the good qualities are present. That's much easier, isn't it? When you can just sit back, lean back, and you can kind of take it easy. This is one of the benefits of, that's why the hard work is usually at the beginning of the path. And as your mind becomes more pure, a lot of the hard work has left behind you. And now you can more just sit back and enjoy some of the results and go into deep meditation as a consequence. And then the last thing the Buddha says, tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled, my mind stilled and unified. And this is what happens when the mind is in this positive state. You have energy. Mindfulness is unremitting. In other words, it's steady. It doesn't diminish. It's always strong, right? The body is tranquil and at ease, and the mind becomes stilled as a consequence. Then the sutta, from here, it goes on to talk about the four jhanas, and then the three higher knowledges afterwards, the tevija, but I've left that out, and we'll get back to that later on, towards the very end of this retreat. Okay, so that is the Dvaita-vitakka sutta. It's a very, very useful sutta. It talks a lot about what I consider some of the most important things on the Buddhist path for most people. Some people who are very, very pure don't have to worry about this, but for the majority of people who are still struggling with these kind of thoughts, I think this gives some very good and profound advice on how to deal with these things. And now I'm going to look a little bit more at that, how to deal with the bad with difficult thoughts. This is called the Vitakka Santana Sutta, which literally means the calming of thoughts. And this gives different ways of dealing with bad thoughts when they arise. What are the different ways we can deal with this? So this is like building on the previous sutta and giving a little bit more ideas of how to deal with difficult thinking here. So this is how it goes. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied, and the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time he should give attention to five signs. What are the five? Here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, and owing to that sign, there arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts, connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should give attention to some other sign, connected with what is wholesome. When he gives attention to some other sign, connected with what is wholesome, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts, connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. Just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, and extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one, so too a bhikkhu follows this procedure. And when he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. So here we have a bhikkhu, anyone, right? Bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, layperson, anyone who is practicing this kind of practice is pursuing the higher mind. The higher mind is the adi-citta. And the adi-citta in Pali always refers to the jhanas. It refers to the samadhi states. So he's pursuing the jhanas, right? He's trying to get to the jhanas. So how does he do that? So to do that, he needs to... There's five things that he can do. It says he give attention to five signs. Here it means something like five ways or five methods or five ways of attending. That's what it means in this particular case. So the five methods, in a sense, you can use to... help you to move towards the jhana states, the samadhi states. This is what this is saying here. And the first one, and remember again that in the Dhamma, these things are always the sequences. If there are five things, the sequences have a meaning. There is a reason why they are in that particular sequence. So the first one is always the most important one, the most powerful one, and the most useful one. So please keep that in mind as we go through this. So a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign. A sign, the Pali word is nimitta. Nimitta, we talk about samadhi, nimittas, and these kind of things. So basically, it just means an object. You're observing something, right? Some kind of thing. Or something arises in the mind, some kind of image of a person or something like that. And because of that person, like you're watching the breath and suddenly something intrudes, like a person you're having difficulties with, right? And then you start to feel a sense of negativity because of that image of that person arising in the mind. So sign here doesn't just mean, it's not just about that particular person, it's also about how we attend to that person. So a sign is a mixture of the object and how we are attending to the object. The object itself does not have, does not necessarily give rise to aversion or negativity. It is often how we attend to these objects that matters the most. So we're giving attention to a certain sign, a certain aspect, we're tending in a certain way, and that is what gives rise to the negative thought. So owing to that sign, owing to that way of attending, bad, unwholesome states of thoughts connected with desire, hate and delusion, lobha, dosa, moha, right? Some kind of defilement arises in the mind. And then what you should do is give attention to some other sign, another aspect connected with what is wholesome. So this is a very kind of standard technique that is used, and very, very useful one. You can use this inside while you are meditating. You can also use it in the daily life outside of meditation. This is a kind of universal way of dealing with negative thoughts. And I'll give you some examples to show you how this works, because it may be a little bit theoretical when you see it like this. But an example, we were talking yesterday about human beings. Human beings are very complex. They have good sides, they have negative sides. Almost everybody is like that. And if somebody doesn't have any negative sides, we will still tend to see negative things in them, right? An arahant comes along and we will still fault find with the arahant. But that is not the arahant's fault, it's because of our own defilements, basically. So you are seeing, so because human beings have these different ways, different aspects to them, you can decide what you focus on. If you focus on the good aspect of somebody, wholesome states arise in your mind. If you focus on the negative aspect of somebody, negative states arise in your mind. So our job then is to shift our attention from seeing the negative to seeing the positive instead. So sometimes you don't have to move. It's not as if you have to change your object at all. You can actually stay with the object and just look at that object in a different way. And then that gives rise to, deletes that negative state and gives rise to a positive state instead. To be able to do that, we have to cultivate seeing the positive side in people. For example, there may be somebody you're having difficulties with, right? And if you are used to always seeing the negative side in a certain person, it is very hard just suddenly in meditation to change your viewpoint and look at that person in a different way. So what we have to do is we have to train ourselves to see the positive side in people, especially those people we find are difficult. So if you find somebody who is difficult, you remind yourself again and again of the positive sides. If there is no positive side, then there are other ways of dealing with it. But if there are some very strong and clear positive sides in that person, you focus on that and you learn to make that perception stronger. And when you have that, it's like you are creating this shelf, right? And on this shelf, all these perceptions kind of sitting there waiting to be used. So when something happens in your mind, you go to the shelf, you pick out the perception that is useful, you bring it into your mind, and then you develop that one in your meditation practice. And that kind of blots out the negative one. For this to work, you have to be very quick, and this is why it often works best in meditation itself. In meditation, hopefully you have a degree of mindfulness. So because you have a degree of mindfulness, not just that, also sampajanya. Sampajanya is what tells you if you are doing the right thing or not. Mindfulness is neutral. You're just aware of what's going on. Sampajanya is what tells you whether you're heading in the right direction or not. So sampajanya has to be quick, right? Okay, I'm heading in the wrong direction. Quickly, let me go to my shelf of perceptions and pull down a perception which is contrary to the one that is happening now. So you remember the good qualities in this person, establish that in your mind, and that abandons and dispels the negative thought that is arising here. Right? You can see how this works. It's not all that hard to do if you have enough mindfulness and you have created a perception beforehand that you can use in this way here. And the same thing with sensuality, right? Sensuality is about to arise. Then you remember, you have another perception, the perception of abandoning sensual desires. So this was perhaps like we were talking about yesterday, remembering the negative consequences. Actually, that is the next stage here. But anyway, it's an example. Remembering the negative consequences of sensuality, getting into that, seeing the danger in that, and straight away you abandon that that thought. So that is how it works. Well, this is often the best way, just to keep on with the same object. Alternatively, what you can also do is, instead of focusing that object, you can change object entirely. You can just forget about that person and remind yourself of somebody else who you associate with good qualities. So that is another way of doing it. We're going to have a look at this later on. If somebody is very, very difficult, you can't see any good qualities in them, then you can have compassion for that person. Because a person who has lots of bad qualities, they are basically creating suffering for themselves, and we can give rise to the perception of compassion instead. So this is what this is meant, right? It's what it means here. You're shifting your attention from the negative to something positive. And when you do that, when you practice in this way, then that bad, unwholesome thought is abandoned and it subsides. And then when it is abandoned, then you go into samadhi, right? Exactly the same phrasing as in the previous sutta, is steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness and stilled. So the mind goes into samadhi. So you go, abandon the bad stuff, give rise to a good thought, and then you go to samadhi. Exactly the same process we saw in the previous sutta. And then you have this nice little simile here with a carpenter, right? The carpenter has a coarse peg. The coarse peg is the bad thought, and you use a fine peg to knock out the coarse one. So all pegs are bad, but it's a gradual reduction in the peg size, right? You've got a big bad peg, then you go into the medium-sized peg, and then you get the fine peg, and eventually you abandon all pegs entirely here. And then when there is no pegs, that is when the mind can become stilled and unified internally. So we are going for the pegless mind here. That is, I don't think, that's new coinage, I think. I don't think anybody has talked about the pegless mind before. That is what comes out of this simile here. Okay, so then that's the first one. And that may not work, of course. Then we come to the second method. If while he is giving attention to some other sign, connected with what is wholesome, there still arise in him evil or bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate and delusion, then he should examine the danger in those thoughts thus. These thoughts are unwholesome. They are reprehensible. They result in suffering. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. And now comes this powerful simile. Just as a woman or a man, young, youthful, and fond of ornaments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around her or his neck. So too, when a bhikkhu examines the danger in those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, brought to singleness and stilled. Right? So you are trying this other method, trying to give attention to some other sign, but it isn't working. The bad thoughts are still arising in your mind. Sometimes they are very persistent, right? There's some very powerful conditioning underneath there that pushes these thoughts to the surface. And even when you try to get rid of them, they keep on coming back. And especially if you allow the negative thoughts to kind of gain a foothold in the mind, once that foothold has been gained, it tends to be much more difficult to get rid of them. So the sooner you're able to deal with it, the better and the more powerful these techniques will be. So then you examine the danger in these things. And this is very much the method that the sutta, previous sutta, Majjhima 19, the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, was all about, remembering the danger, right? Went into that into quite great detail yesterday. And this is, I think, always a very important method to use to remember the danger. The more powerful that danger is established in your mind, the more easy it is to shift the attention. This is probably perhaps a very useful method, and it kind of works in conjunction with the first method, because if you remember the danger, it's much more easy to shift your attention from one aspect of the sign to another one. So they kind of work a little bit together, these kind of methods. So remember the danger, right? So remember the danger of sensuality leads to attachment, leads to must always end in suffering. If you attach, you're asking for suffering in the future. Anger, right? Anger and ill will is often derived from sensuality. You get frustrated, you don't get what you want, all these kind of things. Often it comes from that. And it leads to endless problems in the world, anger and ill will. It leads to violence, to wars, to so many problems in society. We think that we are going to control our anger, but eventually it is the anger that controls us instead. Remember that. You're not really in charge. These defilements are often in charge. So be careful. Don't allow a little bit of anger to linger, because eventually it will grow into a monster that controls you, and you feel like a slave to that anger. This is always a danger. As long as there's a little bit of defilement left, be concerned. That is always something to be concerned about, and something that needs to be overcome. Okay, so you understand that, right? You understand that these thoughts are dangerous. They result in suffering. They are, what does it say here? Unwholesome, reprehensible, savajja. They are faulty. They are with fault, quite literally. Savajja, reprehensible. They result in suffering. And when you remember this, and you have a powerful perception, again, you go onto the shelf of perceptions, right? You have developed this perception in the past, the perception of danger. You bring that perception into your mind, and then you abandon this as a consequence. And then again, your mind becomes steadied internally. Abandon the bad thought, move to the good thought, then the mind gets stilled, and you get to samadhi as a consequence. And this is how strong that reflection can be, right? It's a very, very strong simile. The simile of having the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being hung around your neck, when you're kind of all made up, right, fond of adornments, you're kind of feeling, you kind of think that you're very beautiful or whatever, and then you get somebody puts a dead dog around your neck. Imagine that. How would you feel about that? And perhaps this dog is starting to become a little bit, starting to rot a little bit. Oh, it's really disgusting here. And the result, of course, is that you are absolutely horrified if that happens. You are disgusted. And that is how we should see the unwholesome thoughts, right? You should feel like this dead dog around your neck. You have a dead dog hanging inside your mind. So remember that. This is essentially how, from the Buddha's point of view, how bad these things are. Use these kind of similes to remind yourself of how far you can take this perception of things being dangerous, of things being reprehensible, of things leading to suffering endlessly into the future. So this is just a reminder of the strength of the danger in this kind of thinking here. Okay, so that is the second method, and these two first methods, I think, are very, very powerful and very useful, and these are the sort of methods that I think most people should try. Now we come to methods that are a bit more refined, and these methods can probably be used if you have very strong mindfulness, and it can be used in meditation itself, but I don't think these other methods can be used outside of meditation. The first two methods are very universal. They can be used in meditation, outside of meditation. These next ones are much more refined, and really only, I would guess, most of the time only work in meditation itself. So, this is how it goes. if while he is examining the danger in those thoughts, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should try to forget those thoughts. He should not pay attention to them. When he tries to forget those thoughts, or he tries to be not to be mindful of them, those thoughts, and does not give attention to them, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. Just as a man with good eyes, who did not want to see forms that had come within range of sight, would either shut his eyes or look away. Right? So you shut your eyes, you don't want to see that, so you're refusing to look at this, or you look in a different direction, you don't pay attention. So too, when the bhikkhu tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. So here, you need quite a lot of mindfulness to be able to do this, to just ignore a thought like that is quite difficult. But if when your mindfulness is strong, you're sitting in meditation, you are watching your breath, right? And there's always some thoughts intruding while you're watching the breath. And this thought is coming in, and you know it is a thought you don't really want. What do? You just stay with the breath, right? You don't pay attention to the thought. You just bring the mind back to the breath, and you stay with the breath. And as you pay attention to that to the breath, the thought kind of disappears into the background, and it no longer holds any sway over you. It kind of just disappears by itself. So you just go back to the object. You can do this also, perhaps, in daily life. If you are doing something, you're in the middle of some kind of activity at work or wherever it might be, and some bad thought arises in your mind, you just put your attention back on your work, back on what you're doing, and you don't actually attend to that thought. That's really all there is to this method, placing your attention back to what you are supposed to be doing, rather than the thought itself. Okay, so I think that should probably be clear enough, just like you're shutting your eyes or looking away, right? Looking back to the object of meditation or whatever it is. Okay, method number four. If method number three doesn't work, then we move on to method number four. And if while he is trying to forget those thoughts and is not giving attention to them, they still arise in him, bad, unwholesome thoughts, connected with desire, with hate, or with delusion, then he should give attention to the stilling of the thought formation of those thoughts. When he gives attention to the stilling of the thought formation of those thoughts, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts, connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. Then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And he would stand. Then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And he would sit. Then he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And he would lie down. By doing so, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that was subtler. So too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to the stilling of the thought formation of those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. So this is not perhaps so obvious what is going on here. It's a bit more, little bit more tricky. So to understand what is going on here, you have to understand the idea of thought formation. This is vitakka sankhara. Vitakka sankhara. Now the word sankhara in the Buddhist Sutras, one of the main meanings of the word sankhara is that it's used as a synonym for chaitana. So basically, in most contexts, it means it's very equivalent to chaitana. So chaitana is intention, right? So this is a thought intention, quite literally, the thought sankhara. So it is the intention the will, the volition, the drive that lies behind that thought. This is what this means. So you are stilling the drive, the willpower that lies behind the thought that creates the thinking in the first place. This is what this is referring to. So you're stilling that willpower. And this is one of the things that, you know, when we do the meditation, we often talk about getting into a kind of bare awareness where you're just aware of what is going on, an awareness where you just allow things to be, you allow things to flow, you don't judge things. And the idea behind that is when you just allow things to be, you have bare awareness, you just go with the flow in the meditation, then you don't have any will there. There's no will behind these things, right? So you just go with the flow as things flow. There's no will or volition that controls what is going on. And it's a similar kind of thing that you do here. If a thought arises in your mind, you just observe it. If you just observe it, you're not fueling the thought. The thought to continue needs the fuel of the volition, of the will, to drive it on, to keep it going. But you don't do that. Instead, you just sit back and you observe the thought. And the more mindfulness you have in observing that thought, the more quickly that thought just dies down all by itself. When mindfulness is very strong, the thought just barely comes into existence before it snaps out of existence again. It's just so fast. But if your mindfulness isn't that strong, then you just observe, and then gradually, the thought dies down as you observe. You're not feeding it. You're not giving it any fuel. You're depriving the thought of fuel. So again, this is something that you can do. It requires, again, a fair amount of mindfulness to be able to do this. But it works. It's a little bit similar to the previous method, but basically based on mindfulness. In this case, you're more like just observing the thought. In the previous one, you just refuse to even look at the thought, and you go to the breath or whatever instead. You just see the thought dying down. And eventually, you lie down. Eventually, the thought kind of disappears, right? There's nothing left of that thought. And then again, your mind goes into samadhi as a consequence. And now we come to the last method. And this is the kind of the most controversial, perhaps, of these methods. If, while he is giving attention to stilling the thought, thought volition, of those thoughts, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts, connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion. Then with his teeth clenched, and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. When with his teeth clenched, and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so too, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, a bhikkhu beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind. And then his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. So this method is a method that you have to be careful with using. Because this, if you use this method at the wrong time, usually people choose this method first. This is kind of the standard way. You don't like a thought and you kind of push it out of the way. You use your willpower to crush that thought. This is kind of the standard way people tend to work. We don't want to see it. We kind of try to obliterate the bad thoughts in our minds. But remember that this method is the last method we should use. When all else fails, right? When we have tried everything and we are desperate and this bad thought keeps obsessing our mind, then this kind of thing can be used. But even then, it should be used with care and it should be used with mindfulness. If you are a person who is fairly developed on the Buddhist practice, and you have a degree of mindfulness already. Remember, this is the practice for somebody who's practicing for jhana. They're aiming for the Adichitta, the higher mind. Remember that? Because it's talking to somebody like that, it means somebody who's already quite developed. And if you're quite developed, then you can use this kind of method to benefit. But if your mind isn't that developed, you end up just repressing things. And repression often can lead to all kind of psychological problems if you use it in the wrong way. So be careful with this kind of method. It is really only to be used when somebody is already quite advanced on the path. And this also shows you the importance of understanding that the suttas are gradual, that there is a sequence here, and that this is the very last method, the very last thing you try to do if all else fails. Only then do you get to this kind of macho method where you kind of crush, you know, one thing with another, and you everything. So this is So there you are. So those are the five methods of dealing with unwholesome thoughts in the mind. So I have gone through this a little bit quickly this time. I did this sutta last year as well, or 2 years ago, whenever it was. But I think that is in sufficient depth to give you a good understanding of what is going on. I'm going a little bit fast because there are many suttas here, and there are some very nice suttas coming later on, and I want to be able to go through those as well. So let us move on to the next sutta. We're all still on the same subject of how to deal with bad thoughts, and this sutta is also about that. And this is called Removing Resentment. This is, in the Pali, is the Agata Pativinaya Sutta. It's in the Anguttara 5, the Panchaka Nipata, number 162. And here is one of the few places that specifically talks about how to deal with angry or resentful thoughts. And this sutta is spoken by Venerable Sariputta. And again, it's a similar kind of things as the suttas we have been looking at, but a slightly different point of view. I like this particular sutta because it gives some very clear instructions on how to deal with such thoughts. This is how it goes. There the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus. Friend bhikkhus. Friend, those bhikkhus replied, the Venerable Sariputta said this. Friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment, by which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen towards anyone. What five? Here a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment toward such a person. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure. One should also remove resentment toward such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. So this is the summary of the five types of people. The point here is that everybody belongs to one of these categories. So what that means is that there's no excuse from a practice point of view, really, to have resentment towards anyone, anger towards anyone. There's always a way of dealing with that resentment and anger, regardless of who the person is, right? If the person even is Adolf Hitler, right, still you should not have resentment towards that person. That's what this is saying here. So let's have a look at how this is done in detail. So, number one. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a rag-robed bhikkhu sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure, on that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Right, so here you see exactly what we're talking about in the previous sutta, this idea that people are complex, they have different qualities in them. Here it talks specifically about verbal contra bodily behavior. And I think that is just a way of talking about the fact that people have different qualities. It doesn't mean that you necessarily have to look at those specific things, but it's just a way of saying that there are different qualities in people. Right? And again, it shows us that often all we have to do is change our attention, look at the person in a different way, look at the good sides, and then the bad thought subsides as a consequence. Then you have this nice simile here that shows you how this is done. Right? The rag-robed bhikkhu. So these were bhikkhus who would sew their robes from rags. They would find rags on the roadside. They would find discarded cloth here. They would go to the cemetery and pick the rags off the corpses in the charnel grounds. And they would take those rags and sew it together into a robe. So here comes the rag-robed bhikkhu. He sees a rag by the roadside, right? So he's probably very happy because he sees a rag. And now he can use that to make a robe. And then what he does, he presses it down with his left foot, spreads it out with the right, tears off the intact parts, takes away, in other words, throws away all the bad stuff, the things that can't be used, and takes away the good part with him. Right? In the same way, that's exactly what we do when we see somebody and he has different types of qualities. What you do is you tear off all the bad qualities, just like he tears off the bad parts of the rag. You tear away all the bad qualities, and you understand that this is rubbish, just like the parts of that rag is rubbish. Those bad qualities in other people, they are rubbish. You don't want to pollute your mind with rubbish. It defiles you. It is something that is inherently unpleasant. So you throw it out. And what you take with you instead, what you carry with you as a valuable possession, is the purity, the pure part, the part of the person that actually is nice. And you guard that, and you take that with you as you move along. Again, a very nice little simile there to give this idea. The things that you protect, the thing that you take with you, are the good sides of the people, and the bad sides, you chuck it out, because basically it's rubbish. Okay. Number two. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure? Suppose there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. A man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands, drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when the person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is impure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here is another person who has slightly different good and bad qualities. Or it might be the same person, right? The same person might, the good and bad qualities might change over time, so you have to change the way you look at that person. But the same principle again, you focus on the good and you avoid the bad. Just like you come to this pond, right, the algae and the water plants, these are like the defilements, these are the bad things you see in that person. And when the man arrives, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty and parched, what does that mean? It means that when you have a defiled mind, that's what you are. You are afflicted by defilements. You are oppressed by the heat. The defilements of the mind are often called agi. They are a fire inside of you. You are afflicted by the fire of lobha, dosa, moha, as it says in the famous fire sutta. What's that called in the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, which is the third sutta the Buddha spoke according to tradition. And it says in there, you're afflicted by the fires of these things, right? They are hot. They oppress you. You feel bad. You feel terrible about these things. So a man who is oppressed by the heat is one who is oppressed by the defilements. You are thirsty. You want to find a way out of this, right? A way out of this oppression. And then, of course, the way out of that oppression is that you sweep away the algae and the water plants. You sweep away those defilements. You don't focus on them. You focus somewhere else. And then when you sweep them away, you plunge into the pond. Right? Plunging into the pond is like you plunge into the good qualities. You immerse your mind in the good qualities of that person. And then you drink from those good qualities. You drink with your cupped hands from the pure water which is found underneath all the defilements of the algae and the water plants. It's a beautiful way of thinking about defilements and thinking about the good qualities. You drink in the good qualities. You feel the good qualities. And that allays the thirst and the heat that all the bad qualities are afflicting you with and oppressing you with. And then you drink from that and you then feel at ease afterwards. And then you leave, right? And you feel much better when you leave afterwards. And then, of course, the defilements come back and you find another pond, right? And again, you dive into the water once more. And you keep on doing this until the water plants get less and less and less. Until one day, all the ponds are clean and beautiful. All the ponds, you're always diving into pure ponds and always just enjoying the good qualities. So that is, again, the idea of the same idea again. And the third one here. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind? Suppose there is a little water in a puddle. Then a person might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would think, this little bit of water is in the puddle. If I try to drink it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it, and make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours, suck it up like a cow, and depart. He then gets down on all fours, sucks the water up like a cow, and departs. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily and verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the opening of the mind, the placidity of the mind he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here is a person who has many bad qualities, right? His speech is bad, his bodily behavior is bad, but he has still some good mental qualities. Now this idea that it says here, he gains an opening of the mind. This is vivarana, it's the opposite of nivarana. So it is the subsiding of the negative qualities in the mind, right? And the placidity of the mind is here, what is the Pali here? Cannot remember. But anyway, it means the mind becomes calm and peaceful as a consequence. So that happens only when the defilements die down. So the person gets a peaceful and nice mind state. So you know that. And we know that about other people. Sometimes they are peaceful. Sometimes they are in the kind of good mind state. And we know that just from observing them. So you focus on that aspect in that person, right? You see that. You don't see all the bad things, but you see that. And in this case, it is only a very small amount of good qualities. So you have to be very careful. You have to focus very narrowly on those good qualities. If you look a little bit to the right, look a little bit to the left, then you see the bad stuff, right? You see, don't look there. Just focus very narrowly on this. So you're like the cow that gets down on all fours very, very carefully. You drink up the clean and beautiful water, and you don't allow it to be disturbed by the defilements. So if you look a little bit too far to the right, the defilements come in and disturb the beautiful vision of the purity of the mind that the person has. Don't allow that beautiful vision to be defiled by the disturbances on the side. You focus narrowly on that. Right? This is kind of the power of our abilities of mind. If we use the powers of the mind in the right way, we can do this sort of thing. It sounds almost impossible, right? If somebody has so many bad qualities. But no, if you develop that perception inside of yourself of looking at that thing, you can delight in that tiny bit of good qualities that remains in that person. So, that is that person with a small amount of good qualities. And now number four is the person who you cannot see anything good in, right? You can't see anything good in them at all. And it says, sometimes it is like that in life. It may not be that the person doesn't have any good qualities. Maybe they do, but we just can't see them. We are blind to those good qualities. And then another method has to be used. And we will see what you use then is compassion. So far, what we have done is basically what we have been doing is developing metta. Metta is always about seeing the good in others. Now we are developing compassion. It's important to remember that, to be able to have a sense of metta and kindness towards others, we have to see the goodness in other people first. You may have noticed yesterday when we did the guided metta meditation, I started off by saying, remember what it is, what the nature of good qualities is all about. What is it like to be generous? What does it feel like, right? And then, once you know the feeling of generosity, you project that feeling into a person that you are saying having metta towards. So you bring up the idea of what it is to be generous. Then you know somebody who is very generous, and then you can see that quality, that beautiful feeling inside the person who is generous. What does it feel to be truly kind and compassionate towards somebody? You bring up that feeling, you know what it feels like, and remind yourself that this person has those qualities. In this way, you're building up a very beautiful vision of the other person with all beautiful and nice qualities. And when you do that, when you see the good qualities in somebody else, it is relatively easy to have metta towards them. It's easy to wish them well, because a person who is good is easy to have good thoughts towards that kind of person. So all of the first part here is about that, right? It's reminding yourself of the good qualities in other people. It's all really about preparing yourself for metta practice. Now the fourth method here is about compassion. And it's interesting that this whole sutta talks about metta. You try metta as far as it goes. And only when the metta no longer works, only then do you move on to compassion. That is quite interesting. So metta should always be the primary thing. Compassion should be a secondary thing. Some people like to use just compassion, and it's okay if you are used to that and it works for you, it's fine. But ideally, we start with metta, and then if that doesn't work, then we move on to compassion. Why is that? Why is it that metta comes first and compassion comes afterwards? And the reason is that metta is always about seeing the good things, seeing the good qualities in people, seeing things that are delightful, that are positive. You can never really go wrong with focusing on the goodness in other people. It is not a perception that can go wrong. It always leads to something positive afterwards. That's why metta is so powerful, because it is actually always a positive experience. With compassion, what we are doing there is that we are reminding ourselves of the suffering in other people, and then based on that suffering, we then wish them well. May they be free of suffering. But when we're looking at suffering, it's easy to, if we're doing it in the wrong way, it's quite easy that we can actually go in the wrong direction and feel maybe negative or slightly depressed or feel kind of uncomfortable about seeing the suffering in the world. So it's more difficult to focus on compassion in the right way, and it's more easy for it to lead into a negative feeling of too much suffering, perhaps feeling a bit sad or depressed about all the suffering in other people. So this is the danger in compassion. If it isn't done properly, it can lead you a little bit astray, whereas metta is always a safe bet. And this is why I think the suttas, they always focus on metta first, then compassion. When you look at the four Brahma Viharas, there's always the same sequence: metta, karuna, mudita, and then finally upekkha, right? Always the same sequence: metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, and then equanimity last. And there's always a reason for these sequences, why metta is first. And we're seeing that in this sutta as well. Okay, so I would probably should stop there. I had hoped to get to the end of the sutta, but as always, it is hard to do things with incredible precision, because you really have to give the sutta as they're worth. So I think we'll just have to stop there, and then we'll finish it off this afternoon when I see you again at 3:00. Okay.